Brexit is the nickname that's commonly given to the British exit from the European Union, something that the British nation decided to do roughly a year ago in the summer of 2016. From our neutral position, our friendly position, but our neutral position across the pond, Brexit is the gift that keeps on giving because it has led to one constitutional crisis and development after another, one political crisis after another. It just makes our heads spin, and it's endlessly fascinating. Fortunately, we have William Walton, a lecturer in law from the University of Northumbria in Northeast England, who's explained it to us many times before and who comes back today to explain it to us once again. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it is Brexit Update 2017.
Stay tuned for your Weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
The British have their own constitution. Sometimes people say it's an unwritten constitution. Actually, a more accurate statement would be it's a constitution that's not written down in one place. It's written down in lots of different documents dating back at least to 1215 in Magna Carta. Also, a lot of British statutes, a lot of British court opinions, and lots of customs and simply ways of doing business. All of these things make up the British constitution. So it is that the British decision to enter the European Union over the past several decades, led to significant constitutional change in Britain, change that the voters of Britain decided to reject last year in an extraordinary popular referendum by a narrow margin, 52-48%. The people of the United Kingdom decided that they wanted to reverse this long constitutional drift toward union with Europe and to become more independent, to return in some sense to the good old days. We've talked about Brexit a number of times, especially with a friend of ours. His name is William Walton. He's a senior lecturer in law at the University of Northumbria in Northeast England. He's talked to us about the British Constitution. He's talked to us about Brexit before it happened and after it happened. And recently we sat down and he told me all about what's been happening lately. Here's a hint. It's a lot. We spoke via Skype on June 29th, 2017.
My name is William Walton. I'm a senior lecturer in law at Northumbria University in Newcastle upon Tyne in Northern England.
And you've been on the show several times, William.
I have.
Yes.
I've taken students over to your country, as you know, and we were over there again this April, and I'm afraid we obviously didn't get a chance to meet up, but we took students this time to largely focusing on New Jersey. And even got to Atlantic City, and it was interesting.
There are those people, William, who might say you came all the way across the Atlantic Ocean just to go to New Jersey. But, of course, I would not be among them. I mean, I think New Jersey is a fine place.
The Garden of America.
the Garden State. That's right. Well, at any rate, very happy to have you back on the show again. We've talked about a number of things over the years, but among them has been this strange phenomenon generally called Brexit. And in a few minutes here, if you will, give us an update on the extraordinary developments that this has led to in the last maybe year or so. But before we do that, William, could you just sort of remind people exactly what Brexit is and what happened?
Yeah, well, as you'll remember, this time last year, 1 year and 1 week ago, on the 23rd of June of last year, we had a referendum which asked a simple question as to whether voters wanted to remain or to depart from membership of the European Union. And the departs, or the Brexiteers won narrowly, but they won by 52% to 48%, or 51% to 49% and a bit. And so the decision was made that we would leave the European Union after membership going back to 1972. And of course, that remarkable day, 24th of June, where the resignation of the serving Prime Minister was the third item on the news. That was the departure of David Cameron. And of course, a few weeks later, his position was taken by Theresa May, who became elected by her own parliamentarians as the leader of the Conservative Party, and therefore as Prime Minister. So for the last 12 months, we've had Theresa May as our Prime Minister. And when we had this interview a year ago, and I was up in the Highlands, your first question was, well, is Theresa May an interim prime minister? And I thought what you were asking me was perhaps lost in translation. You didn't really understand the way our system worked, but it seemed you were very prescient in your question, because she is now being referred to as the interim prime minister. We'll come on to that, more about that, no doubt. She called an election in early April, and we've just had that election. And of course, that is tied in with Brexit.
Well, before we get there, and I really do want to talk about that, one of the first things that American listeners will have to get their minds around is that you would actually have a national referendum on a fundamental question of foreign policy. Now, we follow in the British tradition of being a very democratically oriented republic, but or society, but the idea that we would vote whether we were going to be members of NATO or whether we were going to be members of this or that treaty organization in a referendum is extraordinary. I mean, that sort of decision is typically made in our system within our executive branch, and typically in great consultation with the Congress.
Yeah, and ordinarily it would be in Britain as well. But as you remember me saying a year ago, and I think with James Gray, my colleague, a year before that, the Conservatives had to promise a referendum really to nip the bud of the rise of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, United Kingdom Independence Party, which was taking votes away from the Conservatives and threatening their possibility of forming a government in 2015. And UKIP's demand, their raison d'etre, their rationale for being a party, is to secure departure from the European Union. And they struck a chord with British feeling. And the view was that none of the established parties, and you hear this in your country as well, none of the established parties would touch the European Union as an issue. They wouldn't ask the fundamental question, present the fundamental question to the electorate, to do you want to be a member or not? And UKIP kept on beavering away, and the Conservatives, after they lost two by-elections in 2000 and late 14, early 15, decided that they, if elected, as part of their manifesto promise, that they would hold a national referendum on continued membership. And that referendum was held in June of last year. So if you're going back very briefly, David Cameron was elected, as you said to me, the first Tory to have an overall majority since John Major back in 1992, 1993. Mm-hmm. But in order to get that overall majority, he had to make a big promise, and then he had to deliver. And of course, he fought for Remain in the campaign, but he lost, and he felt that he had no option other than to resign as Prime Minister.
But then there was an open question once you got this referendum vote, as to whether it was actually some sort of binding resolution. I mean, then there was a big debate over whether Parliament had to further authorize this exit from the European Union or not. But apparently you all have resolved this as something that is going to happen regardless.
Yeah, that's right. So you're reminding me now. The general feeling was that the referendum was non-binding, but constitutionally, it was non-binding, but politically, it was binding. So it would have been very difficult for a party, for a government, having had the referendum result, to have then said, well, it wasn't binding. There would have been perhaps a political uproar and a loss of face for both the major parties if they'd taken that view, Labour and Conservative.
And Theresa May, if I understood, watching from across the ocean here, she's been quite consistent. She said, I do consider this binding. We are going to exit. I'm simply going to initiate the negotiations at the appropriate time and get the best deal for us that I can. So she's been pretty consistent, hasn't she?
Theresa May?
Yes.
Yes, she has. She was elected, elected as Prime Minister last summer. And her manifesto pledge, when I say manifesto, I mean to that constituency of about 332 Conservative MPs who effectively dictated who our Prime Minister would be. Mm-hmm. Her manifesto pledge was, I'm Theresa May, we've voted for Brexit, and I'm going to make the best deal possible out of it.
Even though she had been opposed to it.
That's right. Well, she had, but I think I said to you in one of your previous interviews that she went missing for about a month before the referendum. And a lot of people commented on that, that she had been Home Secretary for 6 years, which is an invidious position because you have to deal with the police, prisons, national security, and we'll probably come on to that later on because that featured very significantly in our election. And she was seen, as I said to you previously, as a very competent administrator, which is perhaps to be damned with faint praise. But she wasn't seen as somebody who had ideological roots. But nonetheless, she emerged. She beat, if you remember, Andrea Leadsom, who made some silly remarks about Theresa May not having a family. Mm-hmm. And that backfired terribly. And maybe Andrea Leadsom didn't mean it. It was just a comment off the cuff to a newspaper journalist. But of course, it really represented the end of her bid, and she withdrew, and Theresa May was elected by default. But Theresa May has been consistent in that she said, look, we've voted for Brexit, we're not going to vote again. The Supreme Court, very briefly, and I know you want to move on, but you're quite right to say that the issue was ventilated in our Supreme Court by a lady called Gina Miller, a private citizen. She's a fund holder in London. She's a sort of a city, works in the city of London, and very pro-European Union. And she brought a private action, a constitutional action in the Supreme Court, saying that the decision was unlawful, that the executive had to be, the legislature had to be consulted. And the Supreme Court agreed, but then when it was presented to the legislature, they agreed with pursuing Brexit. So in some ways, it was an empty victory.
Okay, so ultimately, the constitutional question was settled that Parliament did have to authorize Brexit, but then Parliament went ahead and authorized it. So there we are. And that, I think, brings us up to at least the beginning of the events of the past year, because that's when I started getting interested again, because Theresa May decided, for whatever reason, that she wanted a bigger majority than she had. So what was up with that, and what happened after that?
Well, that's right. So she inherited the majority that David Cameron had won in the June of 2015 election, which, as I say, he won a narrow, but nevertheless an overall majority. So he didn't have to govern with the assistance of the Liberal Democrats, which, of course, he had to 2010 to 2015. So he got this overall majority. Theresa May said on a number of occasions, it's understood to be 6 occasions, quite adamantly, I am not going to hold a snap election. I'm going to continue governing until 2020, which we have now a fixed term Parliament Act. So the only way that a Prime Minister can have a snap election is essentially with the consent of Parliament. And she, as I say, she reiterated this 6 times, and she went on a Easter holiday to North Wales, walking with her husband, Philip. And I got on the plane to go over to New Jersey. And I got off the plane at New York. And I was told by my colleague who met me, he said, oh, by the way, earlier on today, the Prime Minister announced we're going to have an election.
Oh, my. Something so, happened in Wales.
So it happened, as far as I was concerned, I was in the mid-Atlantic. But yeah, she apparently just came back from her Easter holiday on Easter Monday or the day after Easter Monday. And as I understand it, without consulting her colleagues, she just said, I've come to the decision we need an election because I need a bigger majority. Now, this of course, is the British people aren't stupid. This is in large part, I think, one of the reasons why she got a bit of a beating at the election, because there was no need for this election. But the Labour Party had to agree to it, because if you're in opposition, you can't run away from the possibility of fighting an election. But Labour were in a very, very bad position 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. And when she called the election, most opinion polls had her between 20 and 25 points ahead of Labour.
Okay, so that's probably the reason.
In mid-April, early April, she was going to absolutely crush Labour. And she was using this as an opportunity, not simply to get a bigger majority, but a huge majority. And that's what she thought she would get. And she got a nasty shock.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're speaking with our good friend William Walton, a lecturer in law at the University of Northumbria and Newcastle upon Tyne in England. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, another one that was recorded on my recent visit to Lithuania at Vilnius University. And then we'll come back and speak some more to Bill Walton. Stick around. On my recent visit to Lithuania to visit my wife, the Fulbright Scholar, I spent some time with our Erasmus students who come from all over Europe. And sometimes it was fun to try to figure out where they were from. For some reason, you look sort of Germanic to me. Are you actually from Germany?
Yeah, I'm from Germany.
Okay, what is your name?
My name is Marijke, but actually this name is not German, but it's Netherlands.
Oh, tell me the name again.
Marijke.
Marijke.
Mm-hmm.
Almost?
Almost.
One more time.
Marijke.
Marijke.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm getting closer, and you're saying that's a Dutch name.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're from that part of Germany that's near Holland?
No, not really. My parents are from Stuttgart.
Oh, from Stuttgart. Okay.
Yeah.
And what part of Germany are you from?
I live right now in Freiburg.
In Freiburg? Okay, and that is also in central Germany?
No, it's quite in south. It's between France and Switzerland, near Black Forest.
In other words, I don't know what I'm talking about at all. I have no idea. Okay, that's very good. Well, my goodness, tell me, if you can, what is a federal system of government?
The federal system of government. So we have several levels in a state or in a country. I learned it from you that maybe it's better to say country than state, because if you say state, this is already the federal level, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So we have several levels of government, and one national level is on the top of it, or I would say, and the federal level is between the departments or the states in the national level, and is it governed by themselves.
Okay, so it's multi-levels of government.
Yeah.
Over the same geographic area. Good. Can you think of any countries that have that form of government?
The United States of America.
Right, the United States of America.
That's my
one.
Country.
What
Germany.
Country is that again?
Germany.
Germany. Very, very good. That's right. And what do you actually call the German Federal Republic in German?
Die Bundesrepublik Deutschland.
Bundesrepublik Deutschland. And how old is the Bundesrepublik?
It was founded in 45 after the Second World War, and the Constitution was made in 49.
Right, so the Constitution was made after the Second World War, and then in 1989, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was a major change then. The eastern part of the country was then absorbed into the west as well, right?
Yeah, right.
Did they preserve more or less the same form of government then and just absorb the eastern parts of it?
They get into the Bundesrepublik.
Okay. That's very interesting, because I remember 1989. That was probably far too long ago for you to remember. But when the wall fell and when they had the reunification, Wiedervereinigung, right? That's the name. There was some question as to exactly what form that would take. But I think ultimately the Federal Republic of Germany simply decided to reabsorb all of the eastern sections, didn't it?
Yeah, actually our constitution is called a Grundgesetz, which means ground law.
Fundamental law,
fundamental
right.
Fundamental law.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was if it would change when the reunification will happen. And they decided just that no, because the name, it didn't change anyway.
But you did do one major change. That says you shifted your capital city. It
right.
had been for many years where in West Germany?
In Bonn.
In Bonn, right. And then where did it go?
To Berlin.
To Berlin, exactly right. Berlin is a lovely city. I was just back there a couple of years ago. Have you been?
Yes.
Very good. Okay, well, I think you've probably answered enough questions to get a T-shirt, so thank you very much for your
Thank
time.
You.
We appreciate it very much. Okay. And now it's time to continue our discussion with William Walton, a senior lecturer in law at the University of Northumbria in England. William's been telling us all about Brexit and about the political fallout from Brexit, which include a remarkable recent parliamentary election. Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, was looking for a larger Conservative Party majority. Well, before we get to what she actually got, that would have strengthened her hand then. I mean, at least if I recall from the press accounts I read, that she felt that she would get the supermajority and that then she could get the strongest backing from her caucus and in the parliament from her party. And that would then strengthen her hands in the negotiations that are scheduled to begin here very shortly.
Well, that's what she has said, and other people have disputed that because in many ways the negotiations are, you may say politically, they are linked obviously to the popularity of the president, of the prime minister. You know, that the people negotiating on the other end, if they realise that the prime minister is in a weak position, they will use that to secure greater leverage. But, you know, a contrary view was essentially that it didn't really have any effect upon negotiating style. I think it was back in January she made a statement essentially outlining, in broad terms, what the negotiation strategy would be. And we've had a running debate in Britain now over the past 12 months as to whether there should be hard Brexit or soft Brexit. Now, this terminology is disputed by some people. The person I mentioned to you, Jacob Rees-Mogg, a high Tory, says it's a misuse of language. You either have Brexit or you don't have Brexit. But hard Brexit is taken to mean essentially Britain withdrawing not only from the European Union, but from the single trading relationship or the single market relationship arrangement, and also from the tariff-free zone, which are essentially other components of the European Union. But as I said to you, I think a couple of years ago in our first programme, when Norway withdrew from the European Union, it still retained what amounts to de facto membership. It was still a member of the single market. But in order to be a member of the single market, it had to accept the rule of the European Court of Justice on trading disputes, and it had to accept free movement of labour. And it was free movement of labour, arguably, that was the biggest issue in motivating people to vote for Brexit, although another big issue was, as I said, taking back control so that we make our own laws and we have our own courts. Well, we had those anyway. We perhaps get into the subtleties of that.
Let me pause here for those of you just joining us and let you know that we're speaking with William Walton, a lecturer in law at the University of Northumbria in England. We're talking about Brexit. Now, the European Union has many different parts, and as you pointed out, a significant part of it is the trade arrangement. That's the part that people might want to retain most in Britain, because, of course, that's going to impact your prosperity enormously, you know, what relations you have with these major trading partners. But the thought that you could somehow Brexit your way out of the European Union on the one hand, but still retain this favorable trade relationship and access to the open market is undercut by the fact that that was the major concern of the Brexiteers, as you call them, because, as you just said, one component of being part of this market is the free movement of labor, that is, of people across borders. And that was one of the major issues, is that the Brexiteers were opposed to continuing immigration of Europeans into Britain.
That's right. Yeah, I live in the north of England, and I think I'm largely insulated. By the way, I don't mean this in a way that means I'm glad about it, but I'm essentially largely insulated here from the issues of large influx of European labour. Although there are a lot of Polish people working in coffee shops, even in Newcastle. But certainly the feeling in the south and the southeast was there's an issue of congestion, of the pressures on public services such as the NHS, on infrastructure, increasing population growth. So there was that element to it. We talked before in your previous radio program about the possibility of wages being driven down because of cheaper labour coming in from, you know, former Soviet countries like Poland and Latvia and Romania.
Or in Lithuania, where I was just visiting a few weeks ago, and where they were very open about that, and they said that many Lithuanians had left and that one of their primary destinations was Britain. So this,
because of the language, really.
They're very conversant with English, and because there were simply greater opportunities. And so what it comes down to is that whenever you talk about negotiating a soft Brexit versus a hard Brexit, it boils down to you really can't get what you want, which is open access to a common market without tariffs, et cetera, without agreeing to the free movement of labor. So is that an impossibility, then, that negotiating position that Theresa May has staked out?
I would agree with you, but the Brexiteers, people like Boris Johnson and Liam Fox and David Davis, they would say, no. The trouble with you, Stuart, is you're not understanding the basic laws of economics. There's a trading imbalance between Britain and the European Union that actually favours the European Union in the sense that they have we have a deficit with them.
You buy more from them than they buy from you.
Yeah, so they actually have more to lose from our departure than we have to gain. So they argue that it's in Europe's interest that essentially they'll drop these requirements for free movement to labour. They'll be willing to drop that, but they will still continue to allow us to trade in a sort of seamless fashion without tariffs and without border checks. So
oh,
there are
I
two
see.
Issues here. There's a physical issue of border checks, and then there's a tariff issue.
Just as Mexico is going to pay for a border wall with us.
That's right. Again, we mentioned this previously, but against that, you have the possibility that the European Union will want to make an example out of Britain departing so as not to encourage other countries like Holland and Denmark, where there are strong exit groups who may also want to follow Britain and leave the European Union. And so the European Union itself, as a sort of political project, has a vested interest in saying, right, even if it's to our disadvantage, we're not going to give Britain a good deal on leaving. We'll make it expensive and difficult for them. And Theresa May said in this speech in February that no deal is better than a bad deal. So part of the election that we've just had was not about Brexit, but it was about what kind of Brexit. Labour, although they campaigned to remain, as did the Conservatives, Labour on Jeremy Corbyn said, we must accept the will of the people. So we're not going to take the position of the Liberal Democrats. And the Liberal Democrats have said, if we were ever in government, which is unlikely, but if we were ever in government, we would want to go back into the European Union. Labour realised that the European Union is perhaps toxic to the voters of Britain. And I know it's difficult, sounds odd saying that when you had a 52-48. You know, toxic and 48 don't really go together. But the European Union is not a popular cause, if I can put it that way. And so Labour said, right, we accept the will of the people. The Conservatives said we accept the will of the people. So in the last election we just had, 82% of the voters effectively voted for parties who accepted Brexit. But the Conservatives are perhaps wanting a harder Brexit, or they're more willing to have a harder Brexit. In other words, we'll happily forego membership of the single market, the tariff arrangements, whereas Labour are saying, well, we'd like to try and hang on to some of those, or at least do everything we can to secure the equivalent.
Okay, well, it sounds then like you've got different perspectives on exactly how this negotiation about Brexit should proceed. And that it sounds like there's a fair amount of posturing and chest pounding that's going on. And Theresa May felt earlier this year that the polls were telling her that she could increase her majority and perhaps her strength and her bargaining position by holding an election. So she went ahead and had her election. And you've already hinted at this, but tell us just how big a disaster was it for her?
Well, let's just say something about it. First of all, as you know, in our country, we have quite short running periods. We're not in this electioneering, constant electioneering position that you're in America, where you're on 2-year cycles in your lower house, and members of Congress are perpetually, essentially, looking forward to the next election. So the campaign started on, as I said, something like April of 2018, and finished. You know, we had the election on June the 8th, and it was a very, very unusual election in the sense that, as your listeners will know, we had two terror outrages during the election. During the referendum last year, we had the death of Joe Cox, a Labour MP who was murdered on the streets of West Yorkshire by, if I can put it like this, a sort of deranged individual. And on this occasion, we had two terror outrages, one in Manchester at a concert, and then again in London about 10 days later on the South Bank. Many of your listeners will know the South Bank area around Borough Market, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And these were both what one might call Islamic extremist events. The first one killing 24, and the second one, I think, 7 or 8 people were killed. The second one, I think, fell only about 5 days before polling day. And we had armed police out on the streets of most of our major cities. And really, that diverted attention away from the politics. And a lot of the attention was, is it safe to go to a big soccer match or something like that, or another popular event? And those issues almost dominated the media. Just going back to the campaign, Theresa May presented the campaign in a presidential style. Vote for me, Theresa May, for strong and stable leadership. So this was said at every, this was the tagline, strong and stable leadership. Against, if Jeremy Corbyn were elected, well, the view of the Conservatives, he could only be elected as a leader of a coalition because he himself was not electorally popular, so the Conservatives said. And that coalition they called a coalition of chaos. Now, I mention that because we now have arguably the reverse. Jeremy Corbyn is in a very strong and stable position as leader of the Labour Party, and we have a coalition of chaos between the Conservatives and the DUP, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But she made it very much a presidential style, vote for me, Theresa May, and it wasn't really about the Conservative Party. And she came across as very wooden. She refused to do any TV debates. In the northeast, where I live, in the northeast of England, her visit to the northeast, she was flown in by plane. She then got on Conservative Party, a bus. She was taken to a redundant airfield in the middle of Northumberland, where she met 40 or 50 party workers, spoke to the press, and then left. And that was her trip to the northeast of England, and it was like that across the country. There was no engagement with the public. Jeremy Corbyn, on 2 days before the election, he was speaking to 10,000 people in Gateshead and Newcastle. It was very like the Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. rallies. And they are parallel in many ways. They are similar. So Jeremy Corbyn came alight during the election. He had a great election campaign, and Theresa May had a very, very bad campaign. It was really only with a day or two to go that I think some Conservatives thought, this isn't going as we planned. But even on the day of the election, I think the Conservatives still thought, well, we're going to get an overall majority of 30, 40 seats, which would be slightly bigger than we've got now. And at 10 o'clock on election night, when the exit polls were announced, Conservatives looked very, very, very glum indeed.
Right. In fact, that was the talk of starting a day or two before the election, was of the so-called hung parliament. Could you define that term and tell us if that's in fact what happened?
Well, a hung parliament is no overall control. So we have a parliamentary system, so a little bit like your Congress, except without the president. And the head of the executive obviously sits in the parliament with the government ministers. So they're both ministers of the crown, but they're also parliamentarians who are elected by the constituents of their own constituencies. So Theresa May's constituency is a place called Maidenhead in Berkshire on the River Thames, a beautiful little area. So she's a serving MP, but she's also Prime Minister because she's the leader of the Conservative Party. Now, we have 650 MPs, and therefore, to get an overall majority, you have to have 326. So just do the maths. You have to have one more than half.
Right. And so if no party has an absolute majority, then we call it a hung parliament, because then they have to enter into a coalition with some other party in order to get a governing majority.
Well, there's no coalition. I'll come on to that. So you need 326. She started, I think, with 332, something like that. And she's now gone to 318. So they lost seats. There are two ways of doing this. You can either have a formal coalition, which is what the Conservatives had with the Liberal Democrats 2010 to 2015, or you can have what's called a supply and confidence arrangement, which is a more informal arrangement whereby the other party, which in this case is the Democrat Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, we'll talk about them in a minute, agree to vote with the large party on issues of confidence, if there's ever a vote of no confidence in Parliament, and on supply, which is essentially means the Queen's speech and the budget. Because if you can't get a budget through, you can't govern. Mm-hmm. But on other issues, they're free to come and go as they want. Now, the interesting thing is, I'll mention this because this, I think this may be just of interest to your listeners as to what the implications are. Ministers now cannot really get on planes and fly around the world to go and visit Australia on a trade deal or anything like that, because the fear is that whilst they're away, there may be an important vote in Parliament. It's going back to the days of 1974 to 76, when we had a minority government under Labour in Jim Callaghan's days, when people were being wheeled, or they were being wheeled into Parliament on stretchers sometimes from hospital beds. MPs were not well, but they were still being required to turn up to vote.
You need every vote so badly that you can't even send your ministers overseas because their votes may be required.
Yeah, that's how close it is.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with William Walton, a senior lecturer in law at the University of Northumbria in England, all about Brexit and the remarkable constitutional and political fallout from that fateful decision. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Bill Walton. Stick around. Listening to your Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with William Walton of the University of Northumbria. William's been telling us all about the political fallout from Brexit, including an extraordinary recent parliamentary election in which the Conservatives went from a slim majority into minority status, which is making them take some rather unusual parliamentary measures.
Now, there is talk about coming to a pairing arrangement whereby a Labour MP will pair up with a Conservative MP and they say, right, you know, neither of us will vote. But Jeremy Corbyn may play hardball and just say, no, I'm not going to do that. There's no obligation for him to do that. And we are talking about, you know, high politics of the country. Why should they? So we will see what the implications are. But it does mean now that the DUP in Northern Ireland, the Democrat Unionist Party, they are a very socially conservative party. And this, again, has come under scrutiny because many people find some of their views quite unedifying in the times that we're in. So on issues such as same-sex marriage and abortion, those type of issues, those type of individual moral issues, they have more conservative views. And some people find that the prospect of their being in an alliance with the Conservative Party quite unedifying, but you know, that's where we are. And if it wasn't for the DUP, the Conservatives would not be able to, we'd have to have another election.
Right. So, this election just blew up in Theresa May's face, and instead of having a slim majority, she now has a slim minority. She's had to effectively ally herself with this Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, which is an uncomfortable fit because of their extremely conservative social views. And she's so weak in Parliament now that she really can't even send anybody overseas. So that brings us back to Brexit. It sounds to me like she's weakened her position with Brexit and that the European Unionists are going to be sharpening their knives. And have negotiations begun now?
Well, just before we get on to that, Stuart, and we'll come on to that, but very briefly, with the issue of the DUP, that in itself has been very controversial. John Major, who's now in retirement, our former Prime Minister, leader of the Conservative Party, he and a number of others, senior statesmen, have said, we don't like this idea of the Conservatives forming alliance with the DUP because it threatens the integrity of the Good Friday Agreement, which is the peace agreement in Northern Ireland. And the Good Friday Agreement mandates that the British government must remain strictly neutral. And parliamentarians are saying, how can the Conservative Party, in the event of a dispute between the Catholics and the Protestants, be strictly neutral when they're reliant upon the Protestant Party, the Democratic Unionist Party, because they are the Protestant Party, mm-hmm. For support for their government?
Oh, my gosh. And so this alliance has undermined the entire British strategy in the Irish, continuing Irish question.
Yeah. So, you know, we have perhaps become complacent in this country because for 20 years we've had peace in Northern Ireland. And thank goodness we've had peace. And perhaps the view is that, well, that's just the normal state of affairs now. But you may know that in February this year, the governance of Northern Ireland broke down in Stormont, which is the parliament in Northern Ireland, because Sinn Féin essentially decided they could no longer align themselves with the DUP. There was a power-sharing agreement, and there was a scandal there over a home insulation project, but a government expenditure. It was over government expenditure and the suggestion of inappropriate use of funds. And so the power sharing agreement that had gone on for years came to an end. And today, they had until 4 o'clock today to come to an agreement. Now, this is a devolved administration in Belfast. We're not right. talking about at Westminster. But they still can't come to an agreement.
So, in other words, it looks like we might be in for a rekindling of the Troubles, and at a time when the British...
I hope not, too.
But, I mean, British neutrality then is called into question at the very moment where they might need that neutrality to give them credibility to broker some sort of settlement.
Exactly. So this agreement with the DUP, many people are saying it's very short-sighted for the Conservative Party to put essentially their own position ahead of what is a far more important issue, which is peace in Northern Ireland. So we will see what comes out. But I mention that for your listeners so that you understand that there are constitutional implications for the devolved arrangement in Northern Ireland, as well as what's happening at Westminster.
My. Well, we're getting a little short on time, so let's focus on what's happening in Brexit and what this election has meant for the British position there.
Right. Well, we signed Article 50 or triggered Article 50, which is the departure clause from the European Union. Negotiations started 2 weeks ago, and they're going to be going on over 2 years. The first issue they're negotiating on is what are the rights of the 3 million EU citizens living in the UK, because that had not been resolved in the last 12 months. And what will be the rights of the 2 million UK citizens living in the European Union? A lot of Brits live in France and Spain. They've retired down there. And it would be competent, I suppose, of the European Union to say, well, you know, we will deny them rights if you won't give equivalent rights to European Union citizens living in Britain. So that issue has been discussed. It's not going exactly according to plan, depending upon who you listen to. But then they're going to be discussing, obviously, various trade issues. That's going to be the really important issues. They're going to be discussing that over the next, several months.
Has there been?
But they're not going to be giving a running commentary to Parliament, or probably not. But of course, we haven't talked about the Scots yet. But the SNP in Scotland and the Scottish National Party, led by Nicola Sturgeon, has said, "Look, we do want to be involved in the Brexit negotiations because these are going to affect what happens in Scotland." So we are in a constitutional melee at the moment. I think it's fair to say that.
Well, you mentioned, we mentioned briefly Ireland, but let's talk about Scotland, because, of course, I recall from our earlier discussions that Scotland, by and large, was in favor of staying in the European Union, and that there was talk that the SNP might actually have another referendum on Scottish independence. What's happening with that?
Well, you know, a week is a long time in politics, as somebody once said. that was put on the back burner. What's today? Thursday. I think it was Tuesday was when Nicola Sturgeon... What happened in the election was that in 2015, you'll remember that the Scottish National Party won 53 out of 56 seats, or 56 out of 59 seats in Scotland. It was an incredible achievement. The Conservatives have reappeared as a significant force in Scotland. And back in on the 8th of June at our recent election, the SNP... number of votes, the number of seats they held slipped in Scotland from 56 to, I think, about 33, 35. The Conservatives now hold 15 seats in Scotland, Labour holds 6, and Liberal Democrats hold 6. And in many ways, the Conservatives are only being held in power not only by the DUP, but by Conservative voters in Scotland. Now, Conservative voters in Scotland would want to have the Conservatives in power in Westminster, but the point I'm making is, if we'd had a repeat of the SNP landslide of 2 years ago, Theresa May wouldn't be in power. There would probably be some SNP stroke Labour coalition. But after the referendum, Nicola Sturgeon said a second referendum is now back on the table. And after the election of 3 weeks ago, Nicola Sturgeon announced 2 days ago that, on reflection, it is not a good time to have a referendum on Scottish independence, and she's going to put it on the back burner until the Brexit negotiations have been completed and Scotland can see where it is in terms of what sort of deal it's going to get. So, for the time being, the Scottish National Party, look, it's nothing really to do with Brexit. The Scottish National Party realised if they had a referendum tomorrow on independence, they would lose.
Right. Well, that was always, of course, the concern, is that they might actually be revivified by all of this. But it sounds like that's the one bit of good news for Theresa May and all of this mess, is that it doesn't look like Scotland's going to be seceding anytime soon.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, the other thing we've, there are lots to talk about, I realize that we haven't mentioned, is Jeremy Corbyn did very well for Labour. And
he was considered sort of a joke for a long time. I mean, he was considered this lefty backbencher way in the outfield, as we'd call him. And has he just simply changed his ways, or simply the changing fortunes of politics have favoured him?
No, I think what happened was he was seen very much as in this country, sometimes portrayed as a high school geography teacher, somebody with a beard and an old sports jacket who doesn't pay much attention to his appearance, but as a man of great principle, has stuck by his guns really for 30 years. He's a person on the left of the Labour Party, and he was elected as leader 2 years ago. He was challenged again last year, and he won that, and he galvanised membership of the Labour Party. It now has the largest political party membership of any party in Europe, has about 600,000 members. And what he did during the campaign, and perhaps going back to what, you know, was it Howard Dean a few years ago and Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. really connected with young people. And part of Labour's campaign was to try and get out the young vote. In Britain, we have a lot of people who just don't bother to vote. And everybody was very cynical about this strategy because they said, look, what you need to do is you need to win the swing states. What you call a swing state, we call a marginal seat. Mm-hmm. So it's better taking a vote away from the Conservatives than getting somebody to vote Labour, a young person to vote Labour in a Labour constituency where they're probably just going to bolster an existing majority. But Corbyn had a great campaign in terms of his speeches. They went down very well. He galvanised people. And I think one of the issues that Labour has hit home on is that people are getting fed up with austerity. We had a vote in the Parliament yesterday. And of course, we've just had this awful fire. I haven't mentioned it, but the Grenfell fire.
Yeah, that was horrible too. Very sorry about that.
Well, many people see this as a microcosm of what has gone wrong in Britain. Most of the people who died in that fire were very poor people. They were from overseas. But why did that fire happen? I've got to be careful I say here because there's an official inquiry. But the general understanding is it happened because it was clad in combustible material. And it was clad in combustible material because it was cheaper. And so Labour have got on the
and the concern is that it was done so in defiance of the applicable regulations. Isn't that correct? I mean, that's what I've been hearing.
Well, that at the moment is rather unclear as to whether it was compliant with regulations or non-compliant, because the regulations, many people have said, are rather vague. And I haven't looked at them myself, even mm-hmm. though I'm a lawyer. But there is a suggestion that in large part the material that was used to clad these buildings. And by the way, we are having hundreds of buildings being checked and monitored now, and hundreds, well, certainly over 150 or 130, 140 have failed the test. They've been clad in combustible material, including, I ought to say, one just around the corner from the university where I work. Mm. And they're going to obviously, clearly now, going to have to be declad. But many people, as I say, have said this was a kind of a narrative or a microcosm of austerity in Britain. And we had a survey result yesterday that said something like 60% of people in Britain would vote now for higher taxes if it meant proper funding for our essential public services like the police, our National Health Service, and fire officers, etc.
Building inspectors. Yeah. So there's discontent with the way that government's been running, and you feel that that is going to inure to the benefit of Labour and their newly successful leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
Just very quickly, the problem the Conservatives have now, Theresa May is dead woman walking, as some people say. Mm-hmm. So she's not a credible leader of the Conservative Party. But she cannot be replaced, because if she were to be replaced, and yet again within the space of, 12, 13 months, the Conservatives were to effectively select a prime minister through an internal election. They did it with Theresa May, in the sense that David Cameron resigned, Theresa May emerged. She didn't go before the electorate until the election she called. Well, supposing they get rid of Theresa May in 2 or 3 weeks' time, and it could happen, and somebody like Davis or Boris Johnson were elected as the leader of the party and therefore the prime minister. The view in general view, I think, within commentators is that person would have to go before the British electorate and it'd have to be another election. Well, Labour are... The fear is that for the Conservatives is, do you know what, Labour could win and we could have a Marxist... That's the view, the way it's presented.
And
we could have a more left-wing Labour government than we've ever had before. Now, in many ways, I think what Jeremy Corbyn's doing, the agenda he's putting forward is great, but that's not to the taste of everybody. So for the Conservatives, I think they realise it's probably better at the moment to keep Theresa May in there, because they can't really get around this problem of we can't really just replace her and then not have a general election, because it constitutionally, it causes all sorts of... Well, politically, it's probably not acceptable.
Understood. Well, we're running out of time, so very quickly, William, crystal ball, what's going to happen now?
In terms of our leadership over the next few years?
In terms of the British Constitution and its implications for Brexit.
Well, I many people think Brexit could still be a real mess, and that Britain could be significantly disadvantaged economically at the end of all of this. We may end up with no trade deal with the European Union, and we won't be able to realistically, you know, start new trade deals with other countries. They take years, if not decades, to sign. So this idea that we can opt out of Europe and start big deals with China and Brazil and Mexico and Indonesia and the United States, many people now regard as pie in the sky. So it's difficult to know what will happen with Brexit. Whether the negotiations will just fall flat, we don't know. But in terms of Theresa May, I can't see her staying, but I can't see her going. And so I don't really know. It's difficult to say what will happen, but things are happening day by day. It's quite unprecedented, really, in terms of the scale of events that are unfolding.
Well, William, you keep an eye on it, and we'll keep in touch, and perhaps we'll have you back on in a few more weeks or months, and you can update us again.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our very good friend, William Walton, of the University of Northumbria in Northeast England. What an interesting and, I don't know, unsettling discussion about the political fallout from Brexit for our English cousins. Our executive producer is Wayne Winklin. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment and perhaps even the European experiment.